Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast and to our series, Cause and Effect. I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. With me for this series, Pastor Ben Tomczak from Bethel in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Pastor John Bergeman from Downers Grove, Illinois. Ben, John, good to be with you again. Ben, could you start us off by telling us a little bit about this Sunday in the Cause and Effect series?
I would love to. Thank you for the opportunity to do that. These causes and effects, always so cool to be able to point from one thing to another. And this week we're looking at a cause. God makes promises and there's an effect that comes from that. And that effect is prayer. Prayer is one of those really easy things that's hard. I've talked to multiple people who talk about not knowing how to pray or what to pray. It's something we have to learn how to do. And maybe you think it's like riding a bicycle. You know, they always say that once you know, it's like riding a bicycle. You just get on and do it again. And yet, how many times in our lives are we just stuck on prayer? It takes a lifetime of learning. And there's a word, persistence, we're going to hear in the gospel lesson attached to this Sunday. I have to keep going after it. But that makes it sound like it's all me. It really starts with God. He is the cause of my prayer life. And the cause is his promises. To hear God say something like, God is not a man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind, that he isn't just not a liar, he cannot lie. So when he says things like ask and seek and knock, or in a parable we're going to hear about today, when he says, you know, come after me with all persistence, he means it, and something will happen. And we can find out that since God is not a man, that's not a nagging thing. When we persistently practice prayer and speak to God and push God on his promises, wrestle with him, he actually loves that. And so we have to hold on to those promises in order to pray, even and especially, and this fits with the text we'll think about, when God seems like he's kind of battling us, when he's an adversary fighting or distant, that still he is the God who's made a promise. Come to me, ask of me, seek from me, and I will answer.
Thank you. Speaking of those other readings, John, could you remind preachers what the gospel for the day is and also the second reading before we get into the Genesis account for our sermon text?
Sure. In the second reading from 1 John chapter 5, 13 through 15, just three short verses, but beautiful reminder that we can have confidence if we ask anything according to God's will, he hears us. So as we remember his promises, we can be absolutely confident as we hold him to those promises, pray about it, and we'll receive it. And later we're going to see that bold kind of confidence in Jacob trying to hold on to God's promises as well. And then in the gospel, Luke 18, verses 1 through 8, Jesus tells the parable of the persistent widow. She's pleading before an unjust judge. And finally, he gives in, and Jesus uses that to say, well, just think about our wonderful just judge, how he will delight in listening to our prayers and pleas. And Jesus references to crying out to him day and night. And that's kind of interesting because it reminds us of the story of Jacob. He was crying out to God in the night. Also reminds us of what Jesus did as well, certainly the night before he died, as he cried out to his Lord in persistent prayer before he would go on to the cross.
Thank you. Let's go then to the recommended sermon text for this Sunday, which, by the way, Proper 24 in Year C, Genesis 32, verses 22 through 30. Ben, could you start us off? What do you observe in this text, or what are some things that preachers might draw the attention of preachers as they think about proclaiming this text?
Yeah, the first thing is, I think you really have to see this in its bigger context. It's an exciting story. It's a gripping one. I think it's one that even littlest Sunday schoolers would like, but you got to remember where we are in Old Testament history. Jacob is coming home from 20 years of getting cheated by Laban. And he's going from the frying pan to the fire, really, because he's preparing for a reunion with Esau, his brother, his estranged brother. And he's fearful. How's this going to go? Does Esau still want me dead? That's the last message he got from Esau the last time he saw each other. And that's not crazy, because holding grudges is like riding a bicycle. Once you're on, you're never getting off, and you're never forgetting how to do it. So For all he knows, he's made plans. He's separated his people into multiple groups. He's got these huge bribes, I mean, gifts that he's sending forward to Esau. And now it's the night before. And he's sent some of the people across the river, but he's kind of, maybe can't go to bed, or just he's thinking a little bit. He's already prayed once. He said words, holding God to a promise. Some of the coolest words in the Old Testament. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you've shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I've become two groups. Save me, I pray. And then he appeals to God's promise. He said, "You told me to come back, and you said I'd prosper and have more descendants than the sand of the sea." So he's intellectually wrestling with God. Theologically, he's wrestling with God, and then suddenly it turns physical. This mystery man shows up out of nowhere, and they're just wrestle. There's no lead up into it. There's nothing, and it's clearly a physical encounter that the text makes it clear that they're grappling with each other. This isn't a psychic experience. This isn't a dream or vision. There's this weird thing happening. And then even weirder, as we think about who this mystery man is, the mystery man can't overcome Jacob. Especially once we determine that this is the Lord, which is the clear words that come from Jacob's mouth and the angel's mouth, or this mystery man's mouth, we have to think about that the Lord can't or won't overcome Jacob. In fact, he has to kind of cheat, doesn't he? He has to, while they're fighting, he takes advantage, uses power that Jacob doesn't have, and touches him, and suddenly kind of dislocates Jacob's hip, so he'll let him go, but still he won't let go. And that this messenger pleads, this mystery man, dawn's coming. What does that mean? Is it like Cinderella? He's going to turn to a pumpkin or something, or his power disappears like a vampire at dawn? There's a time limit on it. Esau's coming. We got to wrap this up. So more strangeness that this mystery man says, "Let me go," and Jacob says, "No, I won't. Until you bless me." He demands this blessing. And then we get some evidence that this is more than just some weirdo in the forest. He gives a name to Jacob, a new name, which is one of the themes of this part of Genesis, right? New names. Eve gets a name after the promise, mother of the living. Abram becomes Abraham. Sarai becomes Sarah. The Lord names Isaac laughter. And now, Israel, you've wrestled with God and overcome, and with men and overcome. And then Jacob gives a name to this place, Peniel, face of God. I've seen God face to face, and yet my life was saved. And while this is weird and strange and just a say what now story, this was such a big deal that we learn in the verses after our text, Israel made a tradition out of this. They in their dietary eating, they wouldn't eat certain parts of food in memory of this moment, this battle, this wrestling match between Jacob and the mystery man who is the Lord that he saw face to face. So just a lot of strangeness, while at the same time, it's an awfully straightforward text.
Right. Not complicated in some ways, but awfully mysterious in other ways. John, your thoughts, kind of on the text overall.
Yeah, I like to have Ben talked about the context. The first word I had written down was context. And so it was great that he picked up on Jacob's prayer in verses 9 to 12 before this, because that really gives us the insight to where Jacob is at this point in time. Only looking at these verses, we might say, well, what's Jacob doing? Is he still scheming some way or just. But when you read those verses 9 through 12, we see how much he's been emptied by the afflictions and crosses and trials he's gone through. And now he's looking at the right place for strength. And then for context as well, and this might come out perhaps when you'd preach this, certainly the greater story of Jacob is quite amazing too, to reflect on how often he has just messed up, schemed, cheated, and what a mess his life really is. I mean, the first verse, it talks about he's going with his two wives and two maidservants and all of these people across the Jabbok. I mean, that's just, he's vulnerable right here. He's got this huge group with him. And even the fact that he has two wives and two maidservants, when I do, if I give marital advice to people, I like to say the most basic marital advice is be married to one person at a time. One is fun, two, you're through, three, you should flee, four drop dead on the floor. He's essentially married to four women with all these children. What a mess of a story. And as you remind your people of that context too, their eyes might get open pretty big and jaws drop, going, wow, this guy was not perfect. This guy's kind of a mess. Yeah. And so this is the guy in the context who God is going to appear to. And in such a close way that it's the only recorded wrestling match between a human and God physically in all of history. How amazing that context really is. But then as you look at this section, it really, we even though it's mysterious, some parts of it, how much of this can't we relate to in our hearers as well? It's really emphasized again and again that he is alone in this. And you just ask a few questions. How often haven't you been there? I've been there when you felt alone. Perhaps because of the messes that I've made in my life, perhaps because of things that just came to me from life, perhaps because of a combination of both. But how many dark nights of the soul haven't we felt ourselves into, feeling completely, utterly alone against problems that we do not quite see a clear answer to and longing for hope? Well, that makes this story pretty real and pretty relatable for people today. Certainly feels very relatable for me. And so then, how amazing, of course, what God does. He comes to him, he wrestles with him, and Jacob does not let go of him. And I like what Ben was talking about, the new names of Genesis. And I like this one because in this one, not only does God give him a new name, he asks him what his name is in verse 27. And of course, God knew what his name was. But I think God's saying, what's your name again? Oh, yeah, Jacob, one who grasps. He was almost reminding him of who he was before telling him who he is, his renewed or new status in God. And I think that was just kind of a neat little turn there that God does. And then how neat that he's one who struggles with God and prevails. That word for struggle in verse 28, that could be to contend, to strive, to persevere. Some have even translated that as strongly as fought. But it seems like he's striving, he's struggling with God and with men. And again, how relatable is that to us? And this might come out later when we talk about applying this text to our hearers, but how often have we struggled with life, with humans, and with God when he appears to be the enemy? But by God's grace, we can overcome too. We can prevail. We can endure, just like Jacob. And he goes home, or he stay at the end of wrestling match. He doesn't go home yet, but he remains blessed by God. Even though he doesn't see all the answers to the problems right in front of him, at this point in time, he does not know how the Esau showdown is going to take place, what's going to happen for that the next day. But he is blessed by God, even in the dark night of his soul. And so are we, as we hold on to God's promises and then wrestle with him in prayer.
Thank you.
Thank
Both
you.
of you mentioned the context here, and I wonder that this might be something preachers are thinking about as well. In a sermon based on this text, how much of the backstory do you need to provide? Would you go all the way back to Jacob stealing the birthright or deceiving Isaac, or maybe give a little snippets of what happened between then, maybe at least the what you both mentioned, the immediate lead up to this section. What do you think, preaching on this text, how much of the background story of Jacob do you provide? Ben, your thoughts on that?
I think you just said it there, John, when you kind of sprinkle it in. Maybe movies kind of do that. My daughter and I were just watching the reboot of Superman, Man of Steel, and they kind of do that where they go back and forth, seeing glimpse of him, as he's growing up, learning his powers in the midst of the main story, which is him as an adult and revealed to the world as Superman. So as you're doing this, there'll be opportunities. Maybe you set it up initially with where is Jacob? Why is he here? And why is he at night? What's he wrestling with? But then later you get opportunities to bring in some of the things John brought up, or when he says that word, bless me. Yeah, you maybe think back, why is that such a big word for Jacob? Because that's what caused the whole problem in his life. And that was the incredible thing that even as he's running away, God would bless him with the messianic blessing. So I probably sprinkled through, but you want to be careful not to lose fact of, man, This story gives us a couple incredible things about God, like his willingness to incarnate himself, the incarnation of God, which is a huge thought coming into the end of a church year and building into Advent Christmas, that God deals with us in a fleshly, physical way, and that Christian life is a fleshly, physical thing, not some abstract intellectual agony, and that God would let us win, that he would roll over like a father does with children. Even though, I mean, man, he could crush Jacob with nothing, and yet there he is, pinned and saying, "Oh, you won, you won."
Right. Yeah, John, your thoughts on background?
Yeah, absolutely. There's different ways to do it, and that's a great idea. What Ben said, sprinkle it in, like the Superman reference there. Or if you want to grab their attention right in the beginning, you have to do it judiciously because, like you said, we don't want to lose track of the whole point of this. But you could get attention by just bringing up some of that backstory, perhaps even with a question. What would you call a guy who had 13 children with four women, betrayed his brother, lied to his father, and thought the next day he might die? We call him Jacob. Well, that might get the attention right there. And then that could set you up later in the sermon for, what did God call him? Israel. And it could be a play right there where you could go back and forth on that.
Great, good ideas. Let's talk kind of law and gospel in the text. What weakness, sin, does this expose? Are we looking at Jacob here, and some of his backstory, as you both alluded to, or yeah, what do you think in the context of this account, this Sunday malady for this sermon? Ben, some thoughts on that?
Yep. I think I kind of hinted at it just a moment ago, that I think of so much of my spiritual life as an abstract concept, thoughts. You know, that's the cliche on Facebook, right? Thoughts and feelings, thoughts and prayers, and we all joke that what does that mean? But here, God shows us it's not some ethereal thing. My life with God isn't just in my mind, and it comes into the flesh. So again, you're tiptoeing over to the gospel. Jesus comes into the flesh. The sacraments are in the flesh, but so are the struggles with God and man. And then once that happens, it's like when you punch a bully in the nose and he walks away. I get punched in the nose, or in this case, I get my hip dislocated. The first struggle, the first pain, the first failure, and we let go of God. We turn on God. We blame God. We go somewhere else. I know there can be dishonor and struggle in the Christian life, but then it happens, and I'm surprised. I'm surprised, even though I've read St. Paul, who said we face death all day long, and then gave a list of what the Christian life means: trouble, hardship, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword. I hear God say here, "You have struggled with God and with men," and I'm surprised. And I'm angry at God, and I reject religion and faith because of it. I think it's why Luther, I didn't have a lot of time to Google it. I think it's in Bondage of the Will, but maybe I'm just thinking something. But he kind of has that Luther way of saying it's when God seems farthest away that he's closest to us. When God is damning us, he's saving us. That when he's grappling with us, he's really embracing us and hugging us all the more. So the reality that this is real stuff. Jacob is a real guy. He's fearful of losing his family. And so are we. And we quickly make plans that don't include God. And we get angry when it is a struggle, or when God, this flesh and blood stuff, the faith life is a flesh and blood thing, not just thoughts and feelings.
Thank you. John, ideas for preaching the law from this text?
Yeah, like what Ben just said, too often I am like Jacob at his worst. I scheme and plot and think I can wiggle my way out of things, or don't realize and acknowledge how desperately hopeless I am without God. I think I can do things on my own. And too often I'm not like Jacob at his best. Do I wrestle with God in prayer? Do I hang on and clutch on to God's promises and call God to be who he is like that? Or does prayer become something that is last resort, or it just kind of goes off the screen? So, yeah, Lord help me to remember how desperately I need you, but then to run to you first, your promises, and call to you in prayer. and hold on to you and believe, even those times when it looks like God is the enemy.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking something along those lines as well, that Jacob is someone who has always turned to his own wiles to get what he wanted. Sometimes it's worked out, sometimes it hasn't so well, but this is what he really has to, well, wrestle with, to coin a phrase here. What really can get him the blessing that he wants? He turns to himself first and always has. And I think that is something we can identify with. And is it also a symptom that shows up that we're reluctant to pray because, yeah, we view it as a last resort. Because, you know, when it comes right down to it, we are more effective in our minds at getting what we want than turning to God. Yeah. So think similar thoughts there too. Ben.
And not just as a last resort, but we think of it as kind of a one and done thing. You know,
Yeah.
like that college freshman, that great basketball player, I'll just put in my ear, or with all this NIL stuff, guys are transferring like crazy when someone gets ahead of them on the depth chart, or they didn't play as much, or didn't have success. It's grueling. Jacob went through 20 years with Laban, a 20-year exile where he was getting the shaft left and right. Now, how much did he? Was he also, I mean, being Jacob, but I mean, Laban, he had a crafty, tricky boss, and he's got his brother who hates him, and who does he know what his dad thinks about him, and is his dad alive? All these things, and that's grueling and unbearable. And we think, I threw up a prayer, maybe half-heartedly. But no, Jesus doesn't say, you know, look at your cross while you're walking by, take it up. And sometimes it seems God is the one who's put it there, and that is grueling. It's enervating. It takes a lot out of us, but that's the gospel lesson where Jesus says, always pray and not give up. He puts in parabolic terms, in words, this what he distrib gave to Jacob, the guy who's always been wrestling with life, right? And the guy who's usually been the cheater and finding the right button to push. And we just don't see that in life. It's just, we don't want it to be grueling. God shouldn't be grueling.
Right. Well, pivoting then to gospel promises in the text, what do you highlight for your listeners? John, some ideas there?
Sure, this text is very rich in potential gospel applications, but maybe pick up with what Ben was just saying. Right, when I feel alone, when I feel that God could be the enemy, when it's grueling and cross-bearing, what wonderful good news that I'm not alone, that God comes to us even and especially in times of despair and discouragement, and he is with us completely. He is there totally in his word and sacrament. And when I pray to him, there's not a secretary that's going to pass along the request or even some saint up in heaven, but it's God himself who is hearing me. And when we look at this text, we might think, how incredible that Jacob actually wrestled with God. We can't even fit that in our brains. He was grasping onto God in human form. How amazing that would be. But really, God is no farther or further away from us in word and sacrament and listening to us in prayer. It's the same intimate relationship that we have, even and especially in the dark nights of the soul. What beautiful news that is for us.
Yeah, definitely. Ben, gospel promises.
I don't think you can say enough what John just said there, and I've said it already myself, that God deals with us in a fleshly manner. Here in this text, the incarnation, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the means of grace, but also in answers to prayer. Again, sometimes we're so spiritual. What's that, the old Saul, don't be so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. Well, don't think of God that way either. The first article and the fourth petition make it clear that when God answers prayer, he does it with visible, tangible things. His blessings are more than we could ever ask, imagine, or count. And while at the same time, I kind of hit hard this idea of maybe the Christian life is grueling, don't think that we have to sort of, I don't know, debate with God or that it's somehow our effort. When we think of the catechism, I think someone has to be reading Luther's Small and Large Catechism to prepare for this sermon, his preface on prayer, where he tells us why we pray, because God says so and God makes promises. So that's required reading. But then in the small catechism, when he describes God in prayer as someone who tenderly invites us as a true father to come to him as true children, dear children, and ask. And then in the doxology that we can be sure these petitions are acceptable to him, even if it feels like we're grabbing and hitting and punching and it's a fight, where he's kind of tipped his hand again that he's a parent who's like, yeah, I'm going to let you get this. I'm really going to let you win. I mean, that's half the fun of parenting, right? Where you make it seem like your kids are struggling, that they've won some big battles. Like, I was going to get you ice cream the whole time, dude. This is just going to happen. I'm going to bless you. We're going to take care of you, man. You don't have to do these chores so that we take care of you. That's not how it works. So that God would let us wrestle with him, and the outcome is deliverance from Esau, deliverance from his own cheating heart, deliverance from his stupidity, and deliverance from sin, death, and hell in the Christ who came and wrestled with those things instead of us. So it shifts from a wrestling match we're wrestling to the one where God wrestled with our eternal enemies.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I love that verse. I will not let you go unless you bless me. God pushing us to the point where we have nothing else to say than I just need you to bless me, God. And there are his blessings, right? First and foremost through Christ, but then also in all these other ways as well. What a beautiful promise, right? Yeah, and it is wrestling up until that point sometimes. But right, I like how you said it, Ben. Verse 25, again, it makes it seem as though God was it, when Jacob is overpowering the Lord, or the angel cannot overpower the angel of the Lord, God cannot overpower Jacob. When he touches Jacob's hip socket and wrenches it, it kind of becomes clear he was letting Jacob get in this position where it seems as though God can't escape, but he was in control all along. It's always been God's intention to bless Jacob, right? But there's something for Jacob to learn in this painful process too, and God sees he will be all the better for it when he does. But the blessing certainly will come. Let's open it up to other illustrations, applications. What do you think? Suggestions for preachers, John?
I like what you said there. God's ultimately in control. Finally, he doesn't destroy me. That was a gospel truth too. Jacob's just amazed. He's seen the face of God and he lives. We've seen, in a sense, the face of God in Christ, and we live too. Just a good news encouragement though here too. Ben said I think at the beginning of our podcast, people are always wondering, how do I pray? And I know that oftentimes people express like God won't listen to them because they're not good enough, or that I'm closer to God because I'm a pastor. Put in a good word with the big guy upstairs for me. But this text proves that our prayers do not depend on our righteousness, but God's, right? I mean, Jacob certainly was not righteous in his own sight before God. Psalm 143:1 kind of says that same point. But what beautiful news that prayer depends on his righteousness, so I can come to him boldly. And how neat that finally, in the end, Jesus himself went alone to Gethsemane and cross. He wrestled with men and with God. He was forsaken by God and overcame. So that gives me complete confidence to do this. But then, shifting maybe to some illustrations, I just think when my kids were young, wrestling with them, and I delighted to let them overwhelm me at times. Could I have absolutely put down my 3-year-old son at any time I wanted in the wrestling match? Yeah, I could. But sometimes I would just let him hold on to me and wrestle with me and overcome me. And it was wonderful. I would delight in it. It was something that was close. And research is showing that like that kind of wrestling is actually really good for children when they're young, to be able to wrestle with a parent in a good way and feel close and comfortable and confident with them, even though the parent is completely in control the whole time. But that was one that just came to mind when I thought of that. How awesome that this wrestling match with God, we can have that same kind of confidence too. And in the end, this wrestling match is scripted in a sense. I know the WWF that I watched growing up, in the end, those matches were all scripted. God had a plan for this, right? God was still in control. And the good news in my life is finally in the end, my wrestling match with him is scripted. It doesn't feel like it to me. I feel like it's chaos at times. I don't know what's coming next, but certainly all will turn out for my good, and God delights as I hold on to him.
Thank you. Thank you. Ben, any further applications, illustrations?
Oh man, you opened the door, John. WWE. So a
Ah,
tip
I
for
was baiting
parents.
you, Ben.
Tip for parents, you can never give your kids a stone cold stunner. That's just probably not going to work. But
A lot of
yeah, I
bounds. Yep.
mean, so this text, wrestling, that's definitely, and the wrestling term I thought of, as you're saying, as the heel, right? That's the bad guy. This mystery man, the Lord, kind of appears to be the heel here, right? He grabs a chair that he brought secretly in and whaps Jacob over the head with it, or he's, his manager off the side pulls him down or something, but he's not. He's not the heel. He's actually the face. And his face is a glorious face that we get to see. And then you can bring in the gospel lesson, say, just like he's not the bad guy here in the wrestling match, the heel, he's not the unjust judge in the parable. He is actually a just judge who delights to hear. He's not angry to hear. He's not trying to get you off his back. He delights to hear. And he does give a blessing, just like he gave Israel. He renames us. He renames us in holy baptism. And that name is Christian. He says, you are Christ's. The struggle has been won for you, taking it all off of us. This battling is all off of us, so that even if we are battling with the Lord in prayer, even if we're left with a little bit of a mark from God, a little bit of a limp from living our Christian life, he's called us Christian. And that's the end of the battle. I like what you said, though, about being scripted. God knows the outcome. We wish he'd have worked it out with us like they do in the WWE a little bit more. But the cool thing is we've seen his plans already and say, I can improvise with God.
Right. Yeah, when you know his heart, right, and he's revealed it to us in his son, we can wrestle with him and cry out day and night, yeah, in whatever situation or dark night we find ourselves in, knowing that he will bless us, right? He certainly will. Any suggestions for kind of bringing things together, a key thought, theme ideas, any possibilities for preachers that you have, any ideas? John?
Yeah, I don't have a great theme in mind necessarily, but I mean, just wrestle with God in prayer, holding on to his promises, something like that, or trust that in him you will overcome. I don't know, something like that. I don't have an exact theme worked out, but I think the story itself just kind of lays out pretty well, like Jacob, like us, I guess, is would be one way to easily access this text. And as we kind of talked about at the beginning, take a text that at first could seem obscure and make it very relatable, because I think we can see so much of Jacob in us, and for bad, but then also for good, law gospel. God's promises to Jacob finally are ours too, that we will be blessed, and we are blessed through the descendant of Jacob that would come.
Right. Yeah, Ben, any ideas?
A couple. It's technically too early to be watching Christmas movies, so maybe this doesn't work. But if you can work on your old man voice and go with the blessing, if you want to focus on that idea from National Lampoon's. I got to thinking about the year 1999, and you think about 1999, you might think of films like Star Wars: The Phantom Menace, or Office Space, or Toy Story 2, or The Sixth Sense, or The Matrix, or Fight Club. But you should really think of Galaxy Quest. A great satire on Star Wars and Star Wars fandom. And what was the catchphrase? Never give up, never surrender. That could work, maybe. But for real, the one I thought of, pray God into submission. So grabbing that wrestling image, because the Lord comes to us ready to wrestle, and the Lord has promises for us when we beat him.
Yeah. Excellent ideas. Yeah. Well, any closing thoughts, or things we haven't had an opportunity to share? If not, thank you both, John, Ben, for your contributions today and through this whole series. And we'll turn things over to preachers. Enjoy preachers, this text and proclaiming how God lets us overcome and grants us his blessing.